From the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., this is Update One, the club's official podcast. It features newsworthy stories originating from the NPC facilities, as well as broader topics related to journalism, communications, press freedom, and transparency.
I'm Tom Young with the Broadcast Podcast Committee of the National Press Club. Economists will tell you the financial system depends on trust, a shared belief in certain institutions and facts. Otherwise, a municipal bond, a stock certificate, or even a $100 bill becomes just a scrap of paper. But critics say that trust suffered a crack when President Trump fired Bureau of Labor Statistics Commissioner Erica McIntyre. The firing came after the BLS reported job numbers Trump disputed. We're in the studio with former National Press Club President Mark Hamrick, now the senior economic analyst and Washington Bureau chief for Bankrate. Also, former head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Erica Groshen, joins us by phone from Seattle. She led the BLS during the Obama administration and the first Trump administration. My thanks to both of you for your time. Mark, I'll start with you. Walk us through what happened with the July job numbers and how Trump reacted.
Good to be with you, and thank you for including me in what I think we all understand is an important subject. We thought it might be just another garden variety monthly employment release most recently, and on the face of it, that was essentially what we got. But once we dug into the details of that, as all of us who follow these things closely know, that a given month's economic snapshot of the job market, which typically is headlined by the unemployment report and the payrolls number or the number of jobs added, in some cases the number of jobs lost, those typically dominate the headlines. But in this case, what really dominated the headlines was the monthly revisions for the months of May and June, which subtracted a total of 258,000 jobs. And so all of a sudden, the employment picture looked a lot weaker going back a total of 3 months. And so that was what was dominating the headlines and, raises the question about the momentum of the U.S. economy and, of course, the job market in particular. And then, of course, the president did not like the way those numbers looked. And something like 5, 6.5 hours after the data was released, there were headlines crossing that the president was either seeking the firing of or actually firing the person who was the commissioner of labor statistics, essentially the person whose job it is to run the operation, like our other guest on the phone did previously, in generating this data. And, not unlike the president's branding of fake news or, phony election, the president was making unfounded allegations that the data was of no credibility. And so that's part of why we're discussing this.
Until now, many people didn't know the Bureau of Labor Statistics even existed, but those who rely on employment data certainly knew. Question for Erica. For those who don't follow these things, can you tell us how the monthly employment report is created and what your role there was as commissioner?
Sure. And thank you so much for including me. I'm happy to talk about that. The payroll report has an official name, the Current Economic Statistics, and it is a survey of about 120,000 employers in the country that report on over 630,000 work locations and accounts for about a third of employment in the U.S. every month. These employers perform an amazing public service by reporting just a few things, but very critically, the number of people that they have on their payrolls during the pay period that contains the 12th of the month. So towards the end of every month, the BLS opens up to collect that information from these 120,000 employers who've agreed to participate in the survey. The survey is much more like a business form than it's not an opinion survey. It is a business form that they submit to the BLS. The BLS has computers that collect and compile all of that information. And then a group of industry experts look at the data, divide it up by industry. So there'll be a group looking at construction and a group looking at health services, right? And they will comb through it in just a few days to check for any quality issues and to understand what those numbers say about what's going on in that industry. When they've finished that job, again, these experts looking at it separately by industry, they will then approve it, and it gets put into the whole estimation program that brings them all together. And so a very small number of BLS people then check the total numbers and analyze it for trends. But it's basically, by that point, it's final. You know, it's just, it is a bunch of tables that represent what are going to be the components of the release. And so the commissioner receives that payroll numbers usually Tuesday night or Wednesday morning, gets a bunch of final tables. The commissioner is then briefed on that on Wednesday morning in preparation for the commissioner being able to brief the Council of Economic Advisors on Thursday and the Secretary of Labor on Friday. The only thing that the commissioner has any kind of input into in this whole process is the narrative, the language used to describe what's in the tables that are final. Journalists, I think, will be interested, and it'll make sense to them to realize that the goal there is not to make the discussion lively. The goal there is to make it as objective as possible. So I made the mistake when I first started as BLS commissioner of saying, oh, let's liven this language up. I can help make it more interesting to people. And the people at BLS said, no, that's not a goal. And the example they used was, is the glass half empty or the glass half full? What's the BLS answer? And they said the BLS answer is this is an 8-ounce vessel containing 4 ounces of water.
So it sounds like a very standardized mathematical process.
There is judgment, a little bit of judgment in which of the figures you call out as having changed significantly and which trends you say, well, the change isn't significant, but it's part of a larger trend that that we've been seeing over longer periods of time. But again, it's very objective. The modifiers that they use are pretty circumscribed, and it's all about what went up, what went down, what's the historical precedent for this. The idea is to leave the interpretation to people outside in the policy realm and wherever. But the BLS's job is just to describe it as effectively as possible, but as objectively as possible.
Trump stated without evidence that the July numbers were somehow rigged, and the administration has pointed to the downward revisions. But aren't those revisions a regular part of the process?
Absolutely. So the revisions are not a bug. They are a feature. Right? And what I mean by that is that the BLS plans to have revisions every month because, remember that employers are asked to report what was their, how many people they had on their payrolls during the pay period with the 12th of the month. Well, towards the end of the month, some of them may not have actually completed that payroll because they pay monthly. Or because of, they pay every 2 weeks, and sometimes it's over and sometimes it's not. They may not be able to report immediately because someone in the payroll office is sick, or they're undergoing some kind of turmoil. They're adding a lot of people, they're losing a lot of people, and they're late with their payrolls. So not all of them can get their numbers in on time, and the BLS gives them two more chances to get that number in or to correct a mistake that they might have made the month before. And so BLS wants to be able to get very timely information out, and on the first pass gets somewhere between 60-68% of the employers to report. The next month, that number will be up higher, and by the third time that these employers are reporting, the collection rate, as BLS calls it, is usually about 93-94%. So revisions reflect late-breaking information about employment, and the revisions go through that same computerized collection and table production process as the early reports. Every month, they all go through the same process together. There's no month-on-month judgment about this. This is not, oh, do I like this? Is this good or bad? Let's change it in some way. There's no mechanism for doing that.
Erica, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has commented repeatedly this year about the need for credible data, and he said very recently that we have the data we need, and essentially, in so many words, said we need to continue to have good quality data. We can have a number of things happening at once that may or may not be related to this broader discussion of the quality, but is it not true that the response rates on the part of establishments have been falling? And this is a pursuit that many have said has been underfunded for some time. It's a little like the effort, it seems, to fund the IRS. We all would objectively agree we need to have a revenue collection and enforcement agency, but it seems like members of Congress don't want to adequately fund that. Is it comparably difficult to get adequate funding for BLS and other statistical agencies? And what about that falling response rate issue? Does that undermine the quality of the data?
They're both really good questions. So let me start with the funding question. It is, it has been very difficult for BLS to get adequate funding. In real terms, so inflation-adjusted terms, the BLS's budget has fallen by over 20% in the last 15 years. And BLS is still expected to continue to produce everything that it was before at that same quality, and it's been able to do that. But what it hasn't been able to do is to modernize to deal with the falling response rates that you bring up. So it has continued to produce trustworthy data, and on the national level, the quality of that data has really not suffered very much. But what is suffering is the granularity, the ability to see states and cities separately from each other below the national level, or for demographic groups or by industry, things like that. So that's where you really see rising standard errors and the BLS suppressing some information because it's not publication quality. Now, the funding has been falling. This is mostly collateral damage. The federal government has been reducing funding in all the discretionary areas. But as BLS commissioner, it meant that none of the initiatives that I proposed to be funded to modernize the system were funded while I was BLS commissioner. My first week in office, I eliminated three programs in order to keep the rest of the programs on a safer footing, on an appropriate footing. People are not getting elected to Congress on a platform of good government, that is, providing the public goods that that is essential for government to perform. And BLS and the other statistical agencies no longer have champions in Congress. That's not what the senators and the congressmen have felt was an important priority for them to push forward. There haven't been many people in Congress who have targeted the statistical agencies for reductions, but they haven't supported them either.
Just one final question along these lines, Erica. I know that the private sector over the years has played a helpful and engaging role in working with our civil servants and others to help to ensure the best quality information. Has the administration done anything to undermine that?
I think that baseless attacks on the quality of the data and the objectivity of the data, the trustworthiness of the data, do undermine participation in the surveys. Because why take on the burden of that public service if you have the leaders of the country saying that it's not trustworthy? So it's the baseless attacks have been, are a real concern and do damage to the statistical system. People then are less likely to use it, which means that they're going to rely on worse information, and then you get the undermining of the response rate. So what the private sector can do, of course, is ignore baseless attacks, continue to participate. In fact, I would call on every business leader everywhere to ensure that they participate in these federal surveys. Because if we want the data to be good, then they need to step up. And the BLS cannot, by law, call out large companies or small companies that don't participate. The companies have to take it upon themselves to be good corporate citizens. The other way that the companies have been very much helping the BLS is on providing ways for the BLS to modernize. And what modernizing means in this context really is creating new kinds of products that use as input all the growth of digitized information in our economy, the big data world, right? We have more and more digitized information. The future of the statistical system is producing more and more products that have blended sources. So all those big data sources out there are incredibly large. They're quite useful, but they have some real limitations. They usually don't cover the whole universe. The question isn't exactly what you might want to ask. So the future of more blended data blended statistics taking advantage of all of these alternative sources is one where you combine them to take advantage of the virtues of each one of them and overcome the limitations that they all have, right? And that is going to take an investment. You can't stop doing the payroll survey for 2 years while you get that up and running, or the CPI, the inflation rate, while you get that up and running. We need to invest in advance on data that will be even more timely and more reliable than what we have now, and compensates for falling response rates. But we can't get there without the support from the Hill in the form of funding and whatever structural changes need to be made to accommodate this.
Erica, what was your initial reaction when you heard President Trump was firing the BLS commissioner, and does the bipartisan outcry that we've heard since then give you hope?
So even though I had worried about this possibly happening, knowing the temperament of the president, I was still shocked when it happened and really sad by it, because this is really something unprecedented and unwarranted. I have been very much heartened by the attention and the stream of statements condemning that action, and I hope that will be the silver lining, that now people, all the communities, the business community, the Hill, and the press and the public will be very much more aware of the need for the BLS and the rest of the statistical system and the need to protect its objectivity. I worry very much about what the candidate might be to replace Erica McIntyre. And I hope that there will be a lot of attention to, you know, making sure that whoever replaces her will be the right one to lead the BLS going forward.
Part of the pushback about this has come from a business journalist group. But Mark, you founded the First Amendment Committee when you were president of the Society for Advancing Business Editing and Writing. What did that group have to say about all this?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. This part of SABU, as it's called, the acronym, we love our acronyms in the Washington, D.C. area. SABU is a group that's been around for decades, bringing together business and financial journalists. And when I was in the second year of my 2 years as president, it became obvious to me that there was a need to be fulfilled by this organization to occupy the space and advocacy of the First Amendment. And the unique aspect of that for business and financial journalists is visibility, transparency, and access to robust and credible data. So it's currently, sort of helmed by the current president of SABU, but also a robust committee of individuals that I am fortunate to be part of, a blend of journalists, as well as some professional advisors that are in the legal community. And I would just urge anyone to go to the SABU website and look for the First Amendment statement. But it's essentially everything we're saying in this interview, and that is access to robust and credible economic data is incredibly important for the performance of the U.S. economy, which is the backbone of essentially the nation's economic vitality and the many things that sets the U.S. apart. And if we don't have access to that credible and robust data, then things begin to break. And so that means we lose our ability to make the best possible decisions, whether we're talking about elected officials, we're talking about business leaders, anybody who's a manager in an enterprise, and then ultimately households and consumers, individuals. And Erica has been noting that there have been instances in recent history where countries have had their statistical data undermined. And let's just put it this way, it didn't work out too well.
Erica, a little bit ago you expressed concern about who might become the new BLS commissioner. As we record this podcast on August 12th, there's news that President Trump is nominating BLS critic E.J. Antony as the new commissioner. He's an economist with the Conservative Heritage Foundation. Any thoughts on that nomination?
Bill Beach and I had been speculating before we heard about the nomination about what we would be looking for, and had drawn up a set of qualifications that we thought were important that we wanted to look at. And when this nomination was made, yesterday when we heard about this, I'd say that I started off concerned. First of all, that I had never heard of him before. He's not well known in the business, academic, or public service communities. So as we go forward, I'm going to be looking for a few important things. First of all, qualifications. Are these the qualifications to shore up the trust that we need in BLS's credibility and excellence? And that's, do we see some management experience, deep expertise in economic statistics with the respect of other experts, extensive engagement with the statistical agencies, including BLS, understanding its products and their relevance and their visibility? And then what about ability to interact effectively with both Congress and Department of Labor? A record of understanding that trust and data integrity are mission critical to the BLS. And then my favorite one is has this person read the National Academy's Principles and Practices for a Federal Statistical Agency and ready to commit to following those? So far, here's my take. What I see is a candidate whose professional portfolio is of partisan basically short partisan briefs, really. So all of his writing is in service of a current policy position. None of it is long-term basic research on a fundamental issue. And this is unprecedented for a BLS commissioner. That is not the kind of person that has had this job before. I'm going to invite skepticism of his intentions in, with the public and also with the staff. Right, whether warranted or not, people are going to be look. It's going to make his life a little more difficult if he ends up with a job, and during the confirmation process, it will be more difficult because of this. There also, I think, will be questions about expertise since he doesn't have an obvious scientific research agenda or any publications in peer-reviewed journals. And some of his papers propagate groundless claims that are rampant in the partisan press. Right? And then he really hasn't engaged with the statistical agencies. He may have written these things, but he hasn't really engaged with them on the methods that BLS follows to maintain trust. So from him, I'd like to hear some specific proposals, really specific proposals for how BLS should modernize and how to obtain the funding to do so. And then to circle back to what I said before, I'd like to hear from him a commitment to follow the National Academy's principles and practices for federal statistical agency.
Erica, just briefly, if someone mm-hmm. wanted to do the wrong thing in that job, could they mm-hmm. effectively cook the books?
Not the way the thing stands now. So right now, I mean, before there's a new commissioner in, then we have Bill Wiatrowski, who is a BLS lifer, who I appointed to be deputy commissioner, and everything will run the way it did before. I have no doubts that everything will be just as objective and uncooked, right, as they are now. When a new commissioner came in, if that commissioner wanted to cook the books, then, first of all, they couldn't do it alone. Second of all, they would have to change the access that the commissioner has. That would be very noticeable. The producing these monthly numbers is much more like a factory process. I mean, I described it to you. It's very automated, orchestrated, choreographed. There is no role for the commissioner until after the numbers are final. So to cook the books, you would have to inject people, the commissioner or people the commissioner brought in, into places where there's no, at this point, no room for them. And that would be very noticeable to the staff. I think the culture at BLS, the dedication to objectivity, would mean that, frankly, and this would be a bad day, sad day. You would probably get leaks or whistleblowing or resignations as a result of that. And it would be noticeable to outsiders not only because of that, but because the writing of the releases would be different, and probably you'd be breaking the system as you did it without any warning. You'd be changing it. When BLS makes changes to methodology, they test them out, they tell everybody, they consult with advisory committees, which have been eliminated, by the way, but they would normally consult with advisory committees. They put them out in the national, in the federal register in advance. So to cook the books, you'd have to either go through that process and it would be noticeable that you were creating a way to cook the books, or you would be doing it without that process, and that would be notable because you had not followed the normal process for making changes.
Erica, you stated on social media that the labor market is weakening because of Trump's policy choices, and if he wants better numbers, he should make better choices. What are some of those bad choices?
One of the clearest things to point to is the increase in uncertainty that is registered in all measures of uncertainty, particularly with regard to tariffs, but other actions of the administration. Businesses internationally and nationally are much less have much less certainty about what's going on, and that raises and that's costly. It tends to raise interest rates, for example, and it means that you have more people. Companies can't make decisions as easily as they did before. So I see that as problematic. So the uncertainty about tariffs, the uncertainty about other kinds of immigration policy, things like that, have been problematic. The decline in immigration is a problem because we are cutting off the most important source of workforce growth for our economy. And so that constricts the people who the businesses that employ recent immigrants, and that puts a damper on our economic growth as well. And then actually the shrinking of the federal government's provision of public goods is problematic for all the parts of the economy that rely on those public goods: scientific research, education, statistics, all of that. So we have these changes that really have been, those are the only big changes that we've seen in the past few months. It's not like we can pin this on some other external factor. We have slowing, and we have these policy changes that we know can suppress growth.
And I'll just add, Erica, Gallup surveys on trust in institutions has for many years, and trust in institutions broadly has been a sharp downward spiral, and there aren't many entities that are immune to that. Those that sort of are still at the higher end of the trust spectrum include small business and the military. But, when you're talking about effectively policy changes or initiatives that are undertaken by a given administration or elected officials in general, this administration is working mightily to undermine trust in almost all institutions, including the ones that it is empowered to try to, lend support ultimately to the American people through. There's a rhetorical question that we won't try perhaps to answer here is, well, what is the goal of this, right? But, I worry, no matter who the nominee is, if it was the best possible nominee to go into this job or a comparable role, which will be, by the way, including the Federal Reserve Chair in the coming months to succeed Jerome Powell, the best qualified nominees, which may or may not be the ultimate outcome of who is nominated, will not enjoy a great deal of public trust because the administration seeks to undermine trust in institutions, including the federal government.
I think that is a real problem. It's a good point, a real problem. And as any parent knows, we've told our kids this many times, trust takes a long time to build and a minute to destroy. And so there are some important rebuilding that's going to be necessary. And the sooner we get to start up, get to work on that, the better.
Well, speaking of the trust issue, I'll turn back to Mark for one last question. And it's a worst-case question. If government economic data ever did become politicized and unreliable, if someone did find a way to cook the books, what would that do to the financial markets and financial reporting?
It would undermine their ability to operate efficiently. And we're all dependent on the efficient and successful operation of financial markets, of the institutions and businesses, and ultimately all the consumers who are dependent on this data. And I would say that that is a foundation upon which a society is based. And we know throughout the very long span of human history, civilizations rise and civilizations fall. And we've had a good run in the United States for about 250 years. And this is, as Erica said, what's happening now with this and in so many other situations. The rule of law is unprecedented. And one of the reasons why this discussion is so important is because consumers, essentially everybody who is a pulse-bearing participant in this economy is dependent on the quality of this data, and that's why we need to have this discussion.
So let's hope the discussion continues. We've been talking with Bankrate senior economic analyst Mark Hamrick and former head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics Erica Groshen. Thanks again to both of you. I'm Tom Young, reporting for Update 1 from the National Press Club in Washington.
You have been listening to Update 1, the official podcast of the National Press Club, the world's leading professional organization for journalists and a vigorous advocate of press freedom worldwide. If you have any questions or comments about Update 1, send an email to updateonepodcast@gmail.com.